Another month, another book, another podcast. Welcome back to the Andrew Luck Book Club podcast on Stephen Ambrose's Undaunted Courage. And I'm super stoked to be joined by a former classmate at Stanford University, a former teammate and offensive lineman, a great one from Stanford University, but more importantly, my very good friend, Andy Phillips. How you doing, Andy? Thanks for joining the podcast.
Awesome. The honor to be here, and glad to make the roster, so thanks for having me.
The roster. You had to throw in a football reference that early in this one.
I know. It's
So the backstory on why Andy is joining the podcast is he was visiting Indianapolis on work a couple months ago and brought a book for me to read, and we'd exchanged books in school, and I'd always looked up to Andy. He was an offensive lineman. And older than me, a couple years older than me. I want to say 2 or 3 years older than me. That's right, right?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
And he brought me a book, Undaunted Courage. I said, hey, one of my ancestors was part of the Corps Discovery with Meriwether Lewis and William Clark. Stephen Ambrose, the brilliant author, wrote a book, Undaunted Courage. Here it is. Maybe you'll enjoy it. So it was sitting on my nightstand. And decided, well, this month of July, when we celebrate Independence Day, wouldn't it be a good time to read about the Lewis and Clark expedition, and then also Thomas Jefferson and his sort of brilliant Louisiana purchase from Napoleon? So thank you, Andy.
No, of course, yeah, and you say that, and it kind of makes me laugh because though I am a descendant of John Coulter, who was on the journey, and have kind of had that as my identity for the better part of my life, I didn't read the book until about a year ago. So I had like done this whole thing where I'd had it on my nightstand and sort of done the, oh yeah, well, I'm, you know, done the dance of, oh, I, you know, I'm practically been on the Corps of Discovery. I'm related to the guy, and I hadn't read it myself. So it's still fairly recent for me as well, which is a shame, but it's true.
Well, good. At least it'll be fresh so we can really dive into it. Before we begin, there's a very important question I want to ask you. I want you to explain to people that maybe don't know football that well what the relationship between a quarterback and his offensive linemen are like from an offensive lineman's perspective. Because from a quarterback's perspective, it's like they're your own foot soldiers. You get to tell them what to do all day long, and they basically do it. But they also talk back to you and make fun of you probably more than anybody else. Is that an accurate way to describe it?
I was going to say, I can point back to some times where we were giving you some leg and having fun with it. But a good analogy that I heard from someone recently talking about what does an offensive line do, if you're going to explain that to somebody who doesn't know anything about football. If you think of an offense as an army, undoubtedly the quarterback's a general. He's making the calls. He's making the insights into what a defense is doing, trying to motivate everybody. He's the leader. He's the face of the team. Undoubtedly, he's the general. The offensive line is kind of like the black ops. If you think about it, most
people,
right? Yeah, no, but it works. Most people are not watching the offensive line. If they mess up, that's really the only time they get noticed. If they're doing their job well, no one really notices them, and the offense just sort of, you know, meticulously makes its way down the field and even progressions. And I thought it was an apt analogy, and I've used it ever since I heard it.
That's a much sexier analogy than offensive linemen usually get. Black ops, cool, awesome. Okay, let's dive into Stephen Ambrose's Undaunted Courage, Meriwether Lewis, Thomas Jefferson, and the opening of the American West. And Al, probably like most Americans, you know of the Lewis and Clark expedition. You know of the importance of the Louisiana Purchase, and it's related in some way, the expedition and the purchase to each other. You know, Thomas Jefferson was, you know, obviously a founding father and a president. But beyond that, I don't think I could have told you the first name of Lewis or Clark. I thought maybe they were one person, and they just had an "and" in between their names, something like that. And early on, you realize there's so much to this story, to this expedition, and especially through Meriwether Lewis's perspective, which Stephen Ambrose sort of writes from.
Definitely. The thing that you've touched on in your description there, the thing that I love about history, I was an ancient history major. The majority of the books I've read of late have been some sort of history story and somehow tie into history. And the thing I love about it is it's exactly what you just said. You have this preconception and you have a notion of how history went. And to most Americans, expansion west just seems like a given. Okay, we started with the colonies and, you know, the way west was how we were going to expand to get to the other coastline. And as time ticked on, we eventually just got there and, you know, it was all hunky-dory. But the truth, and this is true of any, you know, notable event in history, the truth is much messier, which I love about this story. It's, you know, starting with the kind of geopolitical notions at the time, Europe is engulfed in war, as you mentioned, with Napoleon. Even at home, the country itself around 1802, 1803 is only, you know, inside a couple decades old. And the political infrastructure within the U.S. was pretty fragile as well. Jefferson and the Republicans were feuding pretty hard with the Federalists, and there was a lot of, you know, a lot of trying to figure out exactly what sort of country we were going to be in. Was there going to be a strong, you know, independent presidency? Was there going to be more of, was the president going to be more of a monarch? Was there going to be a lineage, you know, notion to the government? So these fights are going on. And one of the things I loved learning was that when the purchase was first discussed, not even the purchase, when the journey was first discussed to explore the region, it was looked at as a ridiculous cost because it wasn't a given that the United States could hold on to even the territory that it had. So why would it waste time and resources going out to explore territory that was out in the peripheral when it needed to focus on what it had under its feet, which just seems absurd looking
from our perspective,
a modern American looking back now. But it's one of the little nuances that you pick up with the story that, you know, I love to learn.
And I think it, at least from reading it, the feeling I got that Thomas Jefferson had an idea and a vision, and he pushed it. And maybe he read the rules his own way to get that done. An all water route, you know, through the country obviously was his hope, which did not happen. But westward expansion, I think he maybe had the foresight to understand the restlessness maybe of the American psyche on the frontier, and that men would push west, families would push west, women would push west, no matter what was standing in their way, and you may as well be ahead of it if you're sort of the government. And I think it was a brilliant idea, and also brilliant and complex in this whole story is Meriwether Lewis. What a fascinating character. And obviously a sad ending to his life. But I know reading this, you know, this sort of Virginia genteel, I don't want to say nobility, but gentleman, but really didn't have much of a formal education, right?
Right. Yeah, no, beyond his schooling with, he had some tutoring down in Georgia and was sort of farmed out to some different family members at plantations about the South. But you're right, in terms of formal schooling that a member of the planting class in Virginia would receive, he really didn't have much. The other thing I loved just about his character in the early parts of the book as you're diving into it is this, he's somebody who has just this incredible contrast of personality. On the one hand, he's extremely calm and level-headed, and that's something that his subordinates would later comment on, you know, throughout the journey and after the journey, just what a insight he had, not only to his own emotions, but to the emotions of the people that he was leading. And, you know, that insight that knew when to give a carrot, when to give a stick, when to push and when to pull. He was really tuned into that. And I don't know if you remember that the two stories that Ambrose brings up to capture this when he's a young boy, that apparently he was, you know, 6 or 7 years old out in the middle of a field, and a bull starts charging him. And while his friends take off and run, he just calmly raises a rifle that he had at his side and drops the bull within 10 yards or so of him. And then there's another story about when he and his family are out in the woods at one point, and there's an Indian party that's that they can hear out in the distance, but it's dark and they're starting to get afraid, and they're saying, "Oh my gosh, they're coming. What are we going to do? What are we going to do?" And nobody had the the sense to put out the fire.
Yep.
And so this calm little 12-year-old, I can just picture, you know, this kid looking around and just saying, "You guys are, what are you doing?" And walking over and just dousing the fire himself. And you contrast that with, you know, and you mentioned his end, which is tragic, but you contrast that with what Ambrose has diagnosed as a likely manic depressive disorder. Mm-hmm. And he, especially after the expedition and after he had lost that purpose, you know, was addicted to alcohol, he abused snuff. He, you know, had kind of a risky lifestyle and would go through moods of swings of depression that would last days on end. And so it's just, you know, as the great moments in history have these contrasts where as you know, start to get into the folds and layers, you understand them in a new way. This leader and this man who's known as one of the great leaders of one of the greater expeditions in American history, he himself could not control his own emotions sometimes. And it's just, it's a, you know, beautiful and tragic portrait of the man that you get in the book.
Absolutely. And I think some of the beautiful parts of it, as we referenced, is no formal education. But Thomas Jefferson really groomed him to be the perfect, and he certainly had some natural abilities and abilities early on that you mentioned of this sort of wherewithal to keep his head when all hell seemed to be breaking loose around him, but really groomed him to be the perfect leader of this expedition with his you know, basically being a personal secretary when Jefferson was living in the White House as a widower, so he could understand some of the political nuances around the U.S. And then also sending him to Philadelphia to train with the leading botanists of the time, the leading astronomers, the leading map makers, the leading scientists. And he was truly a scientist, and probably a better scientist than quote unquote professionals in his contributions to science at that time seem vast and vital, and it's amazing that he could sort of have that breadth of and scope of skill to do that.
Oh yeah, no, I totally agree. And you know, one of the things that again kind of stood out just to, you know, in the story as one of those things that you take for granted is the role that you know, their methods and measurements had in a time that, you know, Ambrose describes it as, you know, if you were to compare two eras of history or three eras of history between the time, say, of, you know, the late 1860s with the Civil War and you know, Lincoln as president, Jefferson as president in the early 1800s, and then, you know, say the ancient Greeks had far more in common with the, you know, time of the Jeffersonian presidency than most people realize. It took 6 weeks for something, a message or, you know, a package, anything to get from the Mississippi region to Washington.
Yeah.
You know, by the time of the 1860s, the telegraph had cut that into, you know, minutes, seconds. You know, and the measurements that they were taking, that Lewis and Clark were taking on the journey as they started, they would, you know, literally spend hours every night using what at the time were fairly sophisticated measurement devices. And
if there were no clouds.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Assuming there were no clouds. Exactly. You know, assuming that everything was right and they would be able to develop some sense of where they were. You know, but they were basically using the same instruments that the Greeks had used thousands of years ago to do the same thing. Mm-hmm. So the whole idea starts to get crazier and crazier as you start to put yourself in their shoes and say, okay, well, they don't have modern technology. They don't have that automatic assumed sense of, you know, modern man of just where you are at any given moment. There was no real sense for what Louisiana was as a property, which was another thing that is kind of fascinating. You know, Jefferson originally wants to buy just New Orleans, and then Napoleon counters with, okay, well, how about the whole property, because he had just got it from Spain. And they go back and forth, and they agree to buy Louisiana for $15 million without a real clear understanding of what Louisiana is. And does it extend to the coast? Does it extend just to the Gulf of Mexico? So there's really, you know, they were truly diving into the unknown with, you know, technologies that were no more advanced than something that, you know, any of the ancients would have used. It's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, and the timing of the purchase and the setting out of the expedition was very fortunate, because the expedition was happening no matter what. But I think the purchase made it much easier for and much safer. I think for Lewis, Clark, and the 31 other members of the expedition, just in case they ran into the Spanish, who were also
right.
trying to protect their land and claim more land, and the British from the north, and how heavily invested they were in the fur trade, and how they sort of dominated that market from the beginning. So I did get very proud as an Indiana resident, as a Hoosier, as you know, when the two references to Indiana, the Lewis and Clark expedition officially started in Clarksville, Indiana. That is awesome.
Right. Yep.
And right off the Ohio River, right on the other side of the river from Louisville, because that's where George Randolph Clark, who was William Clark's older brother, settled after the Revolutionary War. He was a great war hero in the late 1700s, and I gotta assume Clarksville is named after him. We can make that assumption, right?
That's what I imagine.
So that's on my list of things to go see in Indiana. Next time I'll have to go through Louisville. I'm stopping in Clarksville, and I think they have a statue there now. And then I think later on in the book, when Lewis is governor of the Louisiana, I think it was governor of the sort of Louisiana territory, they talk about the nearest post office being in Vincennes, Indiana, so which is quite a ways away from St. Louis. Very interesting. And you referenced that mail really took a long time, and Jefferson had no idea if these guys were dead, alive, if they'd made it to, if they were in India, if they'd made it to the ocean, if there wasn't all water out, and their patience. I very much admire their patience.
Yeah, no, it's one of those things where you start to put yourself in that mindset. And I love how Ambrose breaks it off, where you get a couple chapters of, okay, here's the progress that they made. Here are the various tribes that they met. Here are the exchanges that they had. And then you get this glimpse into what Jefferson's seeing, and it's just months on end of nothing.
Yep.
And he's just hoping everything's going okay. It had to be just, it's staggeringly just frustrating at times to sit there and wait for information and then get some information, but not all the packages made it back to Washington.
Yep.
And then they sent some of the Indian envoys back, and some of them didn't make it. It's just, I love the structure that he took of giving you, both sides of the
absolutely. You feel the frustration, I think, a little bit too, that they must have had. And you referenced this, the Native Americans, the Indians, and I think Ambrose does a really nice job of explaining how fortunate and lucky, I guess for lack of a better word, the expedition was in their dealings with the Native American tribes that came across, and also how and because of the times and because of the culture that was, how, I don't want to say pigheadedness, but the shortcomings, I think, of Lewis, one of them being that his unwillingness to treat Native Americans as equals, and his unwillingness to give maybe credit to Sacagawea with how vital her presence, mere presence in the party was, and all the winter camps that they had, around Indian villages. If either one of those villages did not want to help sustain the lives of that expedition, they could have easily have done that, and the expedition would have been another sort of failed part of Voyagers. So I really appreciate it, I think, how Stephen Ambrose broke that down, and then also York, William Clark's personal slave. There's an African American on this mm-hmm. core of discovery, and was as vital as anybody else, and saved lives and did so much, and obviously at the time did not get anywhere near the credit he deserves for his part on the expedition. And another member of the expedition, and the reason we're sitting here talking today, is John Coulter. And if you start page 105, I circle it while I was reading, and I start, Coulter, sweet, got to circle. So page 105 is when John Coulter first shows up. He's in Frederick, Maryland, I want to say, and he enlists in this new expedition with Meriwether Lewis, and then it's a long time until he's really mentioned again. I think at some point in there he's cited for drunkenness or something like that.
They get somewhere up the Missouri, not that long into the journey. It must have been 2 or 3 weeks, and they they're going to take a hunting party. And, yep. you know, Coulter and a couple of the other crew, they say, yeah, it's okay, we're going to go hunting. And what they had done is actually found an old trapping station and gotten drunk for about 3 days.
So they came back with a hangover and no meat.
Right, yeah, hangover, no meat, and I think they were punished by having to stay in quarters for a couple of days or whatever the traditional punishment was. But it's another, you know, clue that gives you some insight into the fact that it was a bunch of very young men that got restless, they got rambunctious, and you know my predecessor and forefather was one of them. But John Coulter was by. You know, any account, he was one of the original mountain men. So mm-hmm. he is probably most famous for his for what happened not only on for being a part of the Coral Discovery, but for what happened on the way back. So mm-hmm. as they had reached the Pacific and turned back around, he actually made the decision with two of the other men on the journey to because they weren't quite ready for civilized life yet. They wanted to stay out and explore and see what else they could find. Coulter himself actually sent out into what became known as Yellowstone National Park.
Awesome.
And brought some of these, you know, if you've been to Yellowstone, you know, there's a haunting, very unique, very kind of scary and alien atmosphere to the whole place where you've got these, you know, pools of, you know, geysers that have these, you know, very vivid yellows and greens and reds and, there are, you know, things erupting and there's all these different animals. And so, you know, part of him coming back eventually, you know, to the West and or, you know, to the, you know, settled American states and telling some of these stories, nobody believed it. So there were whole regions that later on, and if you go to Yellowstone, there's Coulter's Hell, there's Coulter's Rock, the Coulter Stone. So
I know your younger brother is named Coulter. What did he think when you brought him to Coulter's Hell?
You know what? It was actually really cool. So this last winter, I had some family who moved to Jackson Hole, and one of the activities we did that week was to do a snowmobiling trip through Yellowstone National Park.
It was
incredible. I mean, just the experience itself of, you know, rolling through your snowmobile and you've got, you know, bison on one side and these just amazing gorges and everything else. And you get out and see the geysers. But at one point we stopped, we had this awesome guide and he gets us all around him. He goes, now you probably haven't heard of one of the lesser known mountain men, but there was a man named John Coulter. And we all start bursting out laughing. We're like, hey, you're looking at him, right?
That's funny. So what do you know the trace of your ancestry to John Coulter? From your family?
What's funny is he had a bunch of kids. So there are actually like thousands of Americans who are descended to John Coulter.
Awesome.
And every other year there will be this pamphlet that goes out that's like a reunion of all the descendants of John Coulter get together. I haven't gone to it yet. But you know, they get together and have a cookout and talk about how awesome it is.
They're probably supposed to go hunting. They're probably set out to go hunting and then find a trapping station and get drunk instead.
Yeah, there's probably some of that too. But one of the stories I wanted to touch on that's another thing that he's kind of famous for is what's called Coulter's Run. And there are, as with a lot of historical depictions of things, there are a lot of different variations of how it went down. But the basic story is this. So he's out trapping with a friend of his, and they get caught by the Blackfeet Indians, you know, somewhere in Montana. And his friend is killed, but to his great surprise, they keep him alive for 2-3 days and you know, just kind of mess with him for a couple of days. And then one day they strip him naked, they wake him up, and they say, okay, you're free to go. And he quickly figures out that this isn't because they have suddenly found a soft spot in their heart and wanted to let him go, but they're actually using him as tracking practice for their young braves. So he gets about a 12-hour start, and he's famished and he's been beaten. He just, you know, has no real sense of where he is. So he eventually is caught by one of these warriors, you know, quick fight ensues, and he ends up killing the first guy who gets to him. And then here's where the truth kind of, goes in different variations. You know, like the Wile E. Coyote or like old style cartoon where the guy will go in the river and he's got a reed and he uses it kind of.
Yes.
As a snorkel. There's one depiction that has him doing that in a beaver dam for something like 3 days, and breathing through a reed and avoiding capture. An interesting side note is that my wife is related to a man. Her great grandfather is a guy named A.B. Guthrie, and if you're a fan of westerns, A.B. Guthrie wrote the screenplay for the movie Shane, which won an Academy Award.
Cool.
I believe for either best screenplay or best picture. He himself won a Pulitzer. And he actually coined the term Big Sky Country. But one of his earlier projects was he wrote for The New Yorker a story of the John Coulter story. So he told the story of Coulter's run in The New Yorker sometime in the 1950s or 60s. So we met her grandparents when we were first dating, and he says, "Wait a second, you're related to John Coulter?" He goes down in the basement, brings out this article. So one of those pretty amazing little bits of our family history that her great grandfather had written a story about, somebody that I'm related to. So pretty cool.
That is cool. And thanks to John Coulter breathing out of a reed while being chased by Blackfeet Indians, right, that you are here today.
Who knows? Yeah, yes. Never would have had a left guard at Stanford if not.
I know. I'd probably be in a much much worse place. Well, thank you very much, Andy. This was a pleasure. And also, I know, Andy, you're very involved in a charity in the D.C. area in honor of your father. Could you talk about that real quick before we get off the podcast?
Absolutely. Yeah, you're very kind. So my brothers and I, we set up a foundation after our dad was tragically lost in a plane accident before my senior season, so the 2010 Orange Bowl season, as you remember. So from this fund has come an effort. It's a fairly new initiative that we're behind. There's a property on the eastern shore of Maryland called Patriot Point. And Patriot Point is a veterans retreat center that we've gotten behind and are raising money for and throwing resources behind. And it's an amazing place. If you've ever been to the eastern shore of Maryland, you know how beautiful it is. But it's 3 miles of continuous shoreline. We have several bunkhouses that we're building where we can host wounded vets, caregivers, and their families, and give them the time and space that they need to decompress from some of the things that they've been through. And if you're curious and want to learn more about what we're doing, you can go to patriotpoint.org. And we've got photos and testimonials and ways for you to get involved. So thanks for letting me make that quick plug.
Absolutely. I just wish it was called Colts Point, not Patriot Point. But beyond, I think I could get around that in my mental psyche.
Kidding. We'll get the Colts flag hanging up in there. That's a good point.
We'll get a good horseshoe flag out there to hang somewhere. Well, Andy, thank you very much. It really was a pleasure. Thank you for the book. It's piqued an interest in our country's history around the 1800s, and it's amazing the people that you hear about as kids and sort of peripherally study to get into their lives and to see how complex and how amazing and also how sad things could be. So thank you very much, Andy. All the best to your family, and take care, man.
Thanks, man. Yeah, we're overdue to exchange our next book. So
perfect.